But on the fact that here is a man, unknown, just a name, a man who had his leg blown off because he was drafted in the army and fought to fight for government that he didn't believe in. And because he's unknown and friendless, we have a little group of 20 people here tonight to listen to his plea for his job. It's also a beautiful song. But Michael Will Power, of course, is a different caliber from a lot of intellectuals. He's a man. Now, McCarthyism ruled for a period of almost 5 years in the United States. All of our 1950s. It ended up with his attack on the United States Army. Imagine what a mental case this guy was. He charged with some of the leaders of the army. Generals, not the buck privates or sergeants. No, generals were, they were fooling around with that communist group. Oh, brother. And finally, the government had to intervene. Eisenhower stepped in and defended the army. And the United States Senate took him over the hurdles and ruled him out of order, for Pete's sake. So McCarthy went with the wind, and he successfully drank himself to death in a couple of years. Now, McCarthy, at the time of his assassination, was given a lot of thought to the problem of the role of the working class organizations in a period of imperialist decay. And on his desk at the time of his assassination was a document called The Trade Unions in the Period of Imperialist Decay. That's been reprinted as a tiny little pamphlet, I believe. So to keep it in line. And he said that one way that the capitalists will control the trade union movement will be to draw the trade union leadership into the ranks of the government bureaucracy, and thereby control the trade union movement. Well, we see what's actually happened. Why is it that the government is founding Hoffa? Now, we know Hoffa is no angel. We know that Hoffa has a few bucks that he didn't work very hard for. But we also know that there's a lot of trade union leaders that are millionaires, and they didn't work hard either. In other words, they looked the treasury. But why isn't the government hounding them? Hoffa's supposed to be the only bad. Hoffa, they're hounding the Teamsters Union and Hoffa because the Teamsters Union won't buckle down to the government. They refuse to work underneath the board with the government agents the way the other unions do. What's the proof of this? How long has it been now that the workers have been squawking for a shorter work week? It's been going on since the war, a shorter work week. Here we have automation. I talked with my brother from Youngstown, assistant regional director of the steel union in Youngstown. A couple of years ago, he told me that Republic Steel had opened a new plant in Warren, I think he said, just outside of Youngstown, a rolling mill. I remember when the rolling mills came in the early 30s, and they cut the labor force down from about 1,800 to about 120. Now they have this new plant out at the Republic Steel, has a new rolling mill up in Warren, Ohio, and it takes a total of 8 men to run the whole works. About a half a mile long, 3/4 of a mile long, all run by television. Press this button, look at the television, see what's happening a couple hundred yards down the road, and so forth. In the old days, when something went wrong with this big stripping mill, a light would light, telling you where it was, it was wrong. And you went down and you poked around and so forth, try to find out what the hell it was. Now, you're going to get a million lights. Well, that one there, well, that means there's a screw loose away 3/4 of a mile down the road. Tell you exactly what's wrong. So there's machinists, what the hell, there's 3 or 4 machinists. What they have is probably 20 men running the whole mill. Well, I asked them, what's happening to the men? You know, there's about 20,000 steel workers in Youngstown that will never work again at the steel industry. Well, what are they doing about it? You know, the apparatus like himself. He said, what are they doing about it? Don't even discuss it. These steel union officials don't even discuss it. Well, why don't they do something? Why don't they say we want a shorter work day? A shorter work day would mean an increase in the cost of production, wouldn't it? And what's the steel industry occupied in mainly? More production. It would mean a terrific wave of inflation. And the government won't allow that because these flunkies are tied in with the government apparatus, as Potts report told. The automobile union, same thing. The automobile union is engaged in more production. One of a shorter work day there. Every day the plants are being automated. The number of members in the automobile union is shrinking. They can't do anything about it because the leadership is tied in with the whole government apparatus. And that's what Kosky meant, like that the government had to control the trade union movement. Underneath the board, of course. And it's also a method, by having these bureaucrats in the government apparatus, it's also a method to tame the trade unions in the country, and that's what they've done. And the reason that they're out of line with Hawker is because Hawker won't buckle down and accept the status of becoming a labor statesman, as they call them. I'll tell you how they operate. This is a good little story on Sinai. We had a young, ambitious comrade in Connecticut named Mike Sirdlock. And when the war came, he was a shoe salesman, an official in the shoe unit. When the war came, I don't know how he got in the automobile setup. I suppose he did to sort of run away, be a draft dodger. Like a lot of these patriotic gentlemen are, you know, they run into the war ministry to draft, check out of the draft at the same time they're telling you and me, we should go build the army, huh? Everyone but me. Well, Sirdlock went into the war machine, and the first thing you know, he's an official in the Automobile Workers Union in Connecticut. First thing you know, he's president of the state CIO AFL in Connecticut. Well, one fine day, I pick up the paper and I says that the Connecticut labor leader, protege of the senator, what's his name from Connecticut?
Ribbonfoss,
is going to chuck up the presidency of the state CIO in Connecticut and become a statesman over in Europe for the government, the United States government. The United States government sends these labor papers all over the world to tame the labor movement, to show the Europeans how to be good strike breakers. Well, Sirdlock was going to embark on his career as a great labor statesman by going to Europe. So he chucked up the presidency of the Connecticut State AFL-CIO, got his little bag and went down to Washington. Knocked on the door and said, "Oh, here I am." He said, "Oh, look at that. See, the FBI checked up on you and found out you were a Tuskegee. We can't take you." Now, that was a dirty trick. I think that's one of the best stories I've heard from him. This scoundrel was going to go to Europe and be a peddler for American imperialism and preach a little patriotism for the European workers, this guy that was a draft dodger during the war. Well, that's the way they are. Well, what's the result of this whole Cold War period, this wave of reaction, this terrorism that was instituted by McCarthyism, this wedding of the trade union bureaucracy and the government bureaucracy? The whole thing has been a crucification, you might say, of the trade union movement, of the working class, the crucifying of the Stalinists and the Reds in general, the Socialist Workers' Party, in the unions. We can't do anything in the unions. You can't talk, you can't expect to get on the floor of the trade union movement and preach anything about socialism or make any attacks against the government in any way at all, because you don't want to listen to you. In a period of prosperity, for some reason or other, the worker that understood yesterday doesn't understand today. Now we know material conditions and so on and so on, but as Kosky said, why is it that even though material conditions do these things and they can see the material conditions and they have a better standard of living, why don't they still recognize the need of socialism? And why does that work? I probably don't put it plainly, but I hope you get the idea. Kosky said that someday the psychologist will study this and might be able to give us the answer. But the trade union movement is dead. To talk strikes, you're just talking to an empty room while I teach. To talk Labor Party, you're just wasting your time. You're foolish. To talk of any kind of social problems, to try to drag the trade union movement to participate independently in politics, is just a waste of time. So that the radical and the trade union movement has no audience. And to, in one way or another, to get into the trade union bureaucracy, to hold a post in a trade union, means in a period like this, that you'll have to acclimate yourself to the trade union bureaucracy. What does that mean? You can't peddle socialism. You have to soft peddle it. You have to forget that you're a socialist. And by forgetting that you're a socialist, 1 year from now, you forget socialism. And another 5 years, you're a real red-blooded American trade union faker. So the only way that a Trotskyist can function in the trade union movement today is to be an observer, let's say. That's about it. You keep in touch with the individuals in your union. They know that you are red. They respect you for it. You're fine with them. They respect you for standing by your guns. They know that you're crucified, that the trade union bureaucracy has no use for you, that they'll nail you to the cross if you ever turn your back, and so on. But we know that this thing can't last forever. It might last another year. It might last another 10 years. Well, we can hang on. What the hell? We can hang on just as long as a capitalist. Because, don't forget, the capitalist is worried about tomorrow, too. Now, in this period of McCarthyism and the governmental apparatus getting ready for another war, they decided to get rid of the Stalinists. Now, the Stalinists controlled the Maritime Union on the East Coast here, lock, stock, and barrel. They controlled it on the West Coast, lock, stock, and barrel, except the Sailors Union of the Pacific. That was made up of the sailors, not the men, the cooks and stewards and so forth, and the marine engineers. The Stalinists controlled the transport system in New York City and in Philadelphia. Mike Quill was the famous, notorious Stalinist. They controlled the electrical union that had the contract with General Electric, Westinghouse, and so forth. They controlled the mine, mill, and smelters union. International unions they controlled. And it was these kind of setups that held their party together because they could pass out jobs as organizers and so forth and so on. And it's much better to be an organizer and don't take any cheap guff from the boss than to be in the plant answering the bell every morning like a fire hawk, jumping your harness and running like hell down to the out of your stall, down to the place where you're working, and so forth. So these trade unions, the Communist Party, could pass out jobs to their membership. These were only a few of the unions that the Stalinists controlled. They had been driven out of the automobile union by Ruther, in collaboration with the War Department, of course. They never got the first base in the steel union. But in these unions, the government opened up through the trade union leadership. The CIO came into a national convention. Phil Murray introduced a bill or a law, whatever you call it, a resolution, whereby no member of the subversive organizations, Communist Party and so forth, can hold a post of leadership in the CIO. Now, what did the Communists do on this situation? Did they fight it to the death? No, they voted for it. You say it, they got kidnapped. How can I have a public argument? They voted for this resolution saying that no subversive element can hold a post in the CIO. See, they're using Murray. That's their whole maneuver. They're always using people. Well, they use Murray. Well, that resolution passed. So next year they came to the convention. Murray said, hey, you can't be on the National Committee of the CIO, or whatever they call the top leadership committee. Why not? Because you're a Stalinist, that's why. Remember, you voted for that last year. Well, they cleaned them up. They passed a ruling that no union can belong to the CIO that's led by the Stalinists or by Reds. And they had to take a loyalty oath to the CIO. So they declared war on these unions. They split the electrical workers' union. Mike Quill just flip-flopped. He quit the Communist Party and opened up on his comrades of yesterday. A real genuine traitor, not only to the working class, but to his own intimate comrades. Well, you can imagine what a despicable character he is. Curran, who was the darling of the Communist Party in Maritime, the great beloved leader of the Maritime workers, turned his back on the Stalinists and threw them out of the Maritime Union. The Mine, Mill, and Smelters Union was assailed by the United States government, and the leadership sent to prison. because they denied that they were Stalinists, and the government had them under oath at our trial. And here we're on the subject of Stalinism. You can imagine this kind of a blow to the Stalinists. Let's review it. First, the intellectuals quit them in 1939 when the Stalin-Hitler Pact came into effect. And the workers came to the front. The Stalinist rank and file workers were really courageous, heroic individuals. Don't let anyone kid you about that. In 1939, during the Stalin-Hitler Pact, they were on the street corners, running street meetings against the war. They really believed in the Communist Party, and that the Communist Party was against war. Well, and then they flip-flopped in a race for the war machine. You can imagine how the workers felt. They just quit the CP in droves. Then came the driving of the Stalinists out of the trade union leadership. Then came the confession by Khrushchev at the 20th Congress that they were all a bunch of bloody bloodsuckers that came to power by wading through the blood and bones of Lenin's comrades. Then came the Hungarian Revolution. And by that time, the Communist Party did what Mike Tomey's father said at a symposium that we spoke one night with the Stalinist himself as an independent and myself representing the Socialist Workers' Front. The Communist Party did what Mike's father had. They laid down and died. That's what he told me. He said, the best thing you can do for the working class is to lay down and die. Well, after these events, they really laid down and died. Now we come through all this whole period of reaction, of diminishing forces. The Socialist Party, the Socialist Workers' Party is shrinking. Every year, the Socialist Workers' Party is part of the working class, you know. It's part of the milieu of American life. The way the reaction affects the membership in our party, the same as anything else. And I dare say that by 1960-61, the time of Wyatt, what Young Socialist Alliance was formed, we had probably inside of only 400 members. The party was shrinking every year. And the whole great concern among the older comrades was, Jesus Christ, we haven't any young people. The hell's going to become of the party? We're all getting old, we're physically worn out as far as politics is concerned. We can't run around anymore with the Jimmy Higgins work that we did for years and years and years. We haven't any youth to replace us. That was a constant discussion wherever the two factions got together. The wave of prosperity had meant that a couple of decades of youth had passed away from socialism to the bourgeois ideology. We count 10 years as a decade in the radical movement. And it was with the founding of the Young Socialist Alliance in 1960 or 61 that a whole new life was given to the Socialist Workers' Party. Now you may say, well, the Stalinists, the Socialist Workers' Party also lost members too. So they aren't any better off than the Stalinists. No, that's not right. The Stalinists were an all-powerful organization of 75 to 100,000 members, and they're nothing today. They haven't either members, no program. The Socialist Workers' Party, a tiny little party, lost members, yes, but not the way the Stalinists did. Of all the organizations that existed in the 30s, what were they? The Communist Party, the Socialist Party, the Proletarian Party, and these were all larger than we were in those days. You never heard of the Proletarian Party, well, that's long for the wind, too. The Lovestonites, and the Socialist Labor Party, all these organizations, where are they today? Can you tell me of one viable political organization in this country among the American workers outside of the SWP? Not a one. Why did the SWP survive? That's the question. The answer is they had a program. And the program inspired the membership, despite all this adversity, to stick together and hold on with tenacity until the youth came and the youth have come out. And it was with the founding of the Young Socialist Alliance that the Socialist Workers' Party got a new wind and a new hold on life, you might say. And we see what we are today, and next week we'll talk of the Socialist Workers, what the YS meant. Now, we had a political squabble in our party. in 19, after the end of the war, the Goldman Morrow fight. Goldman was a lawyer, a worker lawyer. Came from the working class, studied law, devoted his whole life, you might say, to the defense of the working people. Remember the founding member of the Communist Party? He kicked out of the Communist Party around 1933. He was not a political leader in any sense at all, in a national sense. He was a good speaker, so forth, but he was no political leader. Well, even during the fight with Schachman, Goldman was a bit wishy-washy in showing his teeth to the class enemy inside the Socialist Workers' Party. He didn't like the idea of being too harsh with them. Morrow, on the other hand, came out of the Communist Party, came out of the campus of NYU, I think it was, or Columbia, into the Communist Party. He was an accomplished journalist. His caving in started in 1942. There was a group of German immigrants in this country, both internationals. And in 1940 or 41, they produced the most fantastic document that was ever produced in the history of the Fourth International, called the Three Theses. The whole world has collapsed. They remind you of terrified intellectuals in the corner wringing their hands. Everything is dark. Everything is hopeless. We have to start what? The Socialist Revolution in Europe after the war? Oh, no. We have to start organizing the working class into trade unions. Not political parties, trade unions. The whole thing is hopeless. We have to go back to the beginning of bourgeois democracy, the period of the beginning of bourgeois democracy. We're just emerging from feudalism, I guess. Well, I remember when I read the document, I didn't finish it. My eyesight is too bad at that. There's too many good things in life to read. You read something, you get the line, you can see that, my God, these people are left people, they check this blah, blah. So, Morrow, I knew most of these German immigrants because I used to work in a print shop, and they used to come in. I used to listen to them with a deaf ear. Well, anyway, Morrow was assigned by the political committee to work with these German immigrants and see if he could straighten them out. And Morrow ended up taking over some of their ideas. And one of the ideas was the hopelessness and the helplessness of the European working class. That after the war, instead of a socialist revolution, was going to come bourgeois democracy. Goldman, on the other hand, hardly had the split been consummated with Schachman and his gang, and Goldman started to shed tears over his beloved dear comrade Schachman. And I remember one political committee meeting when Cameron put the question to him about, do you regard Schachman as your comrade? Goldman said, yes, he is my comrade. You'd have to know Jim Cannon to appreciate the look, I guess. Well, that's indicative. It's indicative of conciliationism. And it didn't take long for Goldman to, after he came out of prison, he was one of the comrades that went to prison. He was a lawyer at the same time for the comrades at the trial. He was a small fellow, Goldman was. A very likable chap. Everybody liked Al Goldman. Can't say the same for Morrow. But hardly had he got out of prison when he started to talk about unity with Schachman. And in their mutual feeling of being in a minority against the majority of the leadership of the party, they drifted together, Goldman and Morrow. And they each took a bit of the other's idea. Morrow started to think that, yeah, it would be a wonderful thing to be back with dear old Max. Schachman hated him and he hated Schachman. And Goldman started to discover that, I guess the revolution isn't on the agenda in Europe. Well, they formed a faction. And the fight, we had to have a fight with them at the tail end of the war, going into 1946. Well, there wasn't a socialist revolution in Europe, but it wasn't due to the backwardness of the European workers, don't I? You never kid you about that. It was due to the fact that we underestimated the whole of the Stalinist apparatus on the working class of Europe. We overestimated, we couldn't foresee the wiping out of the European Trotskyists. Don't forget, in the first period of the war, the Stalinists and the Hitlerites were arm in arm. The Stalinists were the fingermen for the German Gestapo against the radicals in all the countries of the European Union that the German army occupied. They were the ones that fingered the Belgian comrades. They fingered the leadership of the French party. And the Belgian party was practically wiped out to the last individual, man and woman. The French party likewise. Well, we couldn't foresee this. And when the end of the war came, we had no leadership in these countries. For that reason, Stalinism had a clear path. The Stalinists took control of the European working class and tied them to the government apparatus of the various countries and saved capitalism. But the point is, you're never going to accomplish a socialist revolution if you have any taint of pessimism in you. Any human, to be in this movement, you have to be bubbling over with optimism. Read Lenin and Trotsky, good God, they didn't have a couple's God until the war broke out in 1940. But they accomplished a socialist revolution in the Soviet Union. Why? Because they had the program and they had the undying faith in the Russian Revolution. That's why they accomplished it. Against the terrific odds of world imperialism, against the terrific odds of every organization in Tsarist Russia, denouncing them as nuts and screwballs. Lenin challenging the government in somewhere around June when they raised the question, who would take the government? Lenin said, we will. Tiny minority of party, without even a program as far as the rank and file was concerned. Just the leadership had the idea, the program, the march of the dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, the same thing in Europe. We didn't have the party. For that reason, Stalin wasn't playing. Now, Goldman and Morrow couldn't rally a couple's God in the party. As I said, our party was so cemented by the faction struggle of 1940 that Goldman and Morrow's ideas fell on deaf ears. And when they finally split from our party, they may have taken only 30, 40 members, that's all. Didn't cut any ice at all. Goldman marched down the street and joined Chapman's party. Morrow hung around the SWP to commit a few little treacherous acts that Morrow was always capable of doing. And he was thrown out of the Socialist Workers' Party and went down and knocked on Mr. Chapman's door and said, well, here I am, Max. And the Workers' Party of Max Chapman said, get the hell out of here. We don't want you. That's what they told Morrow. And Morrow retired to the sidelines. Now the party, it was only a ripple in the party's life. And that's why I don't think it's worth much to go into a discussion on it. But that gives us a picture of how the party functioned. What happened from 1945 up to almost the present time, outside of a ruckus that occurred in the party in 1950, 51, 52, and that was the fight against Cochrane and his gang. Now, we've had a factional struggle against sectarianism. Olaf not wanting unity with the American Workers' Party, not wanting to enter the Socialist Party because it would be a betrayal of principles and so forth. And we saw how, in order for the Socialist Workers' Party and Trotskyism to develop in this country, it was necessary to have an amputation, to get rid of this sectarianism, or else the party could never move forward into the Socialist Workers' Party. Then we saw a big struggle in 1940 against a petty bourgeois section of the party, a class section of the party, that wanted to throw the program of the party overboard because of the war danger. Now we've talked and talked and talked about the petty bourgeois pressures inside the party. The next talk that we'll have on the Cochrane business will be where a section of the working class elements in the party drop the banner and run for cover and for careerism. That will be a discussion next week on the Cochrane fight of 1952. That's it, Thomas, I think. Are there any questions?